Welcome to the Sound Effect Podcast, the podcast about sound effects. My name is Asbjørn Andersen, and I'm the founder of asoundeffect.com.
And I'm Christian Halskjær, founder of Hertz & Bits Sound Effects.
We have quite the sonic adventurer on the show today, right?
Right. For this episode, Jennifer Walden spoke to field recordist George Vlad, who has gone on some pretty wild field recording adventures around the globe. They talked about George's start in sound and his jump into field recording and just traveling the world for sound. And they take a look at some specific collections and trip he's taken, like when he went to Ethiopia for his volcano collection and his more recent trip to Namibia and much more besides that.
Sounds good.
Yes.
And as always, there are some interesting new releases from the sound effects community as well.
Yes, absolutely. This time we have some trains from Sri Lanka. We have some electrical sounds, some vintage switches and mechanical gizmos. And of course, we also get a listen to George Vlad's latest from the Namib Desert.
Awesome. Well, let's hear it. Actually, before we continue, a quick heads up that George Vlad is generously giving away 9 ambiences from his sound effects libraries for free. Get them at asoundeffect.com/GV. That's asoundeffect.com/GV. And now, on with the show.
African Desert by Mindful Audio is a collection of immersive stereo soundscapes recorded in the remotest parts of the Namib Desert. It covers a variety of locations, with everything from wind and sand movements to insects, birds, and reptiles, with a focus on the lifeless beauty of this mostly barren landscape. Trains in Sri Lanka by Rail Audio gives you a collection of old diesel and electric train sounds. You get idles, screeching brakes, pass-bys, and the sweet rhythmic sound of moving trains. Arcs and Sparks by Penguin Grenade is an essential collection of electrical sounds created through the processing of non-electrical sources, going beyond the limitations of literal electricity. Vintage Buttons, Switches and Mini Mechanicals by EffectsWorks is a large collection of mechanical sounds from vintage tape recorders and tools from the 70s and 80s, including lots of mechanical switches. Next up is an interview with field recordist George Vlad about his travels and field recording adventures.
Hey, this is Jennifer Walden. So I'm here with field recordist, travel blogger, and owner of Mindful Audio, George Vlad. George, you traveled the world to remote destinations to capture pristine natural soundscapes free from human influence, as your website says. But you also chronicle these trips, and you post them to Mindful Audio's blog page. So you take beautiful photographs and record videos, and you write about your travels and recording experiences. I was following along on your latest trip to Namibia, and I gotta say, it's really enjoyable that you make your field recording trips an experience that others can like follow along and live vicariously through you.
Yeah, I try to do that. It's not always possible because obviously sound recording comes first, and then hopefully some conservation work, and then maybe some photography and some videography. And also enjoying it and immersing myself into the landscape, into the soundscape. So I don't always manage to do that. There's some expeditions that I still need to write about, but I try to record video. So this is something I try to do, not just for documenting or for remembering. It's just like to record memories and to record things that happen on expeditions. very often when I'm on location in such a remote place, a lot tends to happen. Things that, you know, I would be in the UK, that would require maybe a few months to happen, and it's all compressed in a few days or in a few weeks. So it's difficult to remember everything. And this way, by getting video of me talking to a camera and just telling about what was happening, it's easier for me to remember and to go back there and to identify things when I have to write about the trips or when I have to edit my recordings or whatever. So I made it a habit, and I think it's kind of second nature now. It just doesn't feel like too much work.
So let's just jump back a little bit. I wanted to talk to you about how you got started in the sound industry. So how did you get started, and where did you get your start in sound?
Right. Well, I mean, how further back do you want me to go? I think I was fascinated with sound since I was a toddler. And growing up, I was always very much into music and into all kinds of weird sounds. And I think I became a DJ around when I was, I mean, a wannabe DJ when I was about 14. And I had a pretty big collection of records and of music and cassette tapes and, you know, everything, all the media that I could find back then in Romania. And very slowly, I kind of built this musical culture, I would say, or I was, you know, I wanted to know more. I was always very curious. And this translated to also wanting to know more about producing music and about the various ways in which this music is created, including electronic music. And that's when I discovered DAWs, digital audio workstations, and virtual synths. And that got me hooked on music production for a few good years. And I was doing this while I was doing very different jobs. I was working as a driver, as a landscape worker. I was working on construction sites, all kinds of random things like that that I wasn't passionate about. And in the evenings and on weekends, when I had a little spare time, I would fire up my computer and try to learn or try to produce some music that I thought was good back then. Spoiler alert, it wasn't any good. But this taught me how to use these DAWs and this software. And very slowly, I became quite, I was okay. I could reproduce music that I would hear. I could create the sounds that I had in my mind. And eventually, I think around 2010, I realized that I could make money with this. Yeah, that was basically when all the App Store started to become a thing. And there was a lot of mobile games and a lot of mobile studios that didn't really think about audio too much. Some games would come without audio at all. Others, they would have audio, but it was pretty rubbish. So my first foray into the industry was to do some sound editing, sound design, and some music composition. And I would approach studios online and tell them that their audio sucked, basically. And obviously, a lot of them didn't even get back to me. And a few did, and I started to work on a few mobile games, very small ones. And it was very organic. It grew from basically very little jobs that I would get done in a day or two to working with studios for a month at a time, maybe a few months, and then eventually to working. I now have worked with a studio for about 7 years at this point, and I'm the entire audio team. So even if at first I did a lot of various odd jobs in audio, like editing podcasts and audiobooks and doing a lot of random things like that, I eventually managed to hone in onto the game audio side of things. And that has been my main job, so to speak, for the past 8 or 9 years at this point. And doing this, I think around 2013, I realized that I was lacking a lot of source material for my work. And when I realized that, back then there wasn't really that much availability for sound effects libraries. There were a few big ones. There was Frank Breeze, the Recordist. There was, I think Tonstern was around back then as well. There was Tim Preble's stuff. And, you know, I got most of the things that I could get, but I was still missing a lot of stuff. So I just had to go out and record my own. And at first it was a bit daunting, but eventually I realized that it was another learning curve, you know, like I had started in sound design and sound editing. As I was going out and recording my own things, I realized that my skills in sound recording were pretty rubbish. So I started from the ground up. I started to read about it. You know, I don't think there was a lot of tutorials online or other stuff that, where you could learn. There was some educational material on sound design, and it covered some of the sound capture elements, some like microphone pickup patterns and some technical aspects like that. But there was a lot of trial and error involved, and especially when I started to go out of the studio, that was even more challenging. And it was, yeah, it was very organic. I got to a point where I was happy with my skills and I could go out and record around Europe. And then eventually I went to Africa and then to South America, Southeast Asia, and it all became quite a thing for me.
So discovering what mics work best for what recording situations, you know, obviously mics are really expensive. How were you able to just like work with a whole bunch of different mics, or were you able to work with a bunch of different mics until you found ones that worked for you and setups that worked for you?
Well, not at first. As I said, everything grew very organically. I never had access to a lot of different equipment all of a sudden. So I think my approach, obviously because I couldn't even afford it back then, my approach was to just get the cheapest microphones and recorders that I could get, which at first was a very humble and disappointing Zoom H4N. And with that one, I would go out and record. I didn't even have a wind jammer at first. And this taught me the limitations of my equipment. And a few months later, I had to sell it because I wasn't really happy with this level of self-noise. But most of all, it was very unreliable. It would turn off for no reason. It would go through batteries like crazy. So once I did that, I think I got a big and clunky recorder. I think it was a Edirol or something like that. And very slowly built on my experiences. And as I was earning more, basically, with my skills and with my work, I would get a bit more equipment. So I got a shotgun mic, which I thought that would be my main microphone for a long time, because I was very interested in recording isolated sounds. But my understanding of a supercardioid pickup pattern was a bit limited. I thought this was like a magical thing that would just pluck sounds out of the air without recording any of the background sounds. And as you and I know, obviously, this is not the case. Even though you have a quite a focused pickup pattern, other sounds will still be picked up. You know, the conditions need to be perfect for you to just get what you want. So eventually I was a bit disappointed with shotgun microphones. And obviously they have their own use, and I still have, I have two or three at this point. But I kind of started to move from this approach of recording isolated sounds, and I became fascinated with soundscapes and with how sounds interact with one another and with the environment and how they bounce from surfaces, or maybe they're, you know, all of these interactions just fascinated me. So I put the recording of individual sounds to the side for a bit, and I've been focusing on cardioids and omni microphones and what you can capture with them ever since. And yeah, as I said, at first it was very costly to get microphones and recorders, but yeah, this is like, what, 11 years later, I think I have a good collection. I was never in a hurry to get a lot of microphones or recorders, even though it's very tempting. I think I liked the element of outgrowing my equipment and just learning as much as I could about one piece of gear, using it as much as I could, getting the absolute best that I could get with that thing, and then moving on from there and improving and getting something that was a bit more costly maybe and had a bit more functions, a bit more flexible. And eventually I realized that what I'm looking for is equipment that can withstand temperature and weather and humidity. And I think I'm happier with something that's a bit more noisy but can survive in very trying conditions, as opposed to something that sounds really clean and pristine and really good but might start popping and clicking in a bit of humidity.
So it sounds like you made this transition from focusing on isolated sounds where you didn't want the backgrounds in to recording the backgrounds, right? These sounds are trying to be on your tracks, so why not let them be and give them the spotlight?
Well, I think that sounds like giving up a bit, and I haven't really given up on that. I've done some recording with shotgun microphones and with parabolic reflectors, and even... there's an approach that I learned by working with the Wildlife Sound Recording Society and by attending their workshops. you can record very clean takes of birdsong if you put a very small lavalier microphone either in a nest or somewhere where a bird perches, for example, like on a branch or on something that, you know, a song post, for example. And this takes a lot of skill and a lot of patience and a lot of observation and some knowledge of like ecosystems and ecology and all of these different disciplines that I had no idea even existed before I started to do this. But now I think I'm pretty confident to record birds without having to use the shotgun microphone. I can just use my lavalier microphones, of which I have 30 or 40 at this point because I like them so much. But they're omnis, and you would think that you wouldn't get such a clean sound. But it's all about the distance between your sound source and the microphone.
So you're working in the studio. When did you decide to start Mindful Audio? Like, when did you know it was the right time to leave the studio and take this leap in a new direction?
Well, to backtrack a bit, as I said, I started to record things, for better or worse, around 2011. And then in 2013, when I lived in Scotland, I was working in the studio a bit too much. I sometimes did 100 hours a week, which looking back seems crazy, and I would never want to go back there. But, you know, back there in terms of doing as many hours. But one good result of that was that I burnt out, so the only thing I could do was just go out and not think about work anymore. So I kind of started to get out. I first did some photography and then sound recording just for my own purposes. And I liked to go out at 3 a.m. in spring and be out as the dawn chorus would start and then progress and to just listen. And eventually I started to record it. That's where I started to buy more equipment because I found that the handhelds that I had were a bit limiting. And I never thought about it in terms of putting together a collection for other people to use. I just wanted to create my own sound effects library that I could use in my own projects. And as I was doing this, I was sharing this online. I was sharing some of my recordings on SoundCloud. And it was Asbjorn who asked me if I wanted to create a sound effects library. He was just starting a sound effect back then. And I said, well, I never thought about it, but yeah, why not? I could do that, I think. And it was a daunting thing to do and just think about creating something that other people will see. I was very much feeling like an imposter. I didn't want to share my recordings for other people to examine and to maybe critique and then say, you know, who's this guy, you know, who's going to record so many birds and then sell it to us or share them with us. So very slowly from that idea, I started to read about sound effects libraries. There's some really good books by Paul Verostek. I think they're still very good. They're still very actual. And it was about selling sound and about creating sounds that are easy to find and, you know, thinking about what to record and how to sell it. Obviously, you know, this would be late because I already had this plan to record to release a library of birdsong and of natural ambiences from the places I was recording in. But it really did help me focus and it helped me, you know, understand how to prepare these sounds. And I found it very useful. And I found the discussions with Asbjorn as well very useful. And it was a big stab in the dark for me. I had no idea what to expect. I hoped I would eventually get to a point where I could make money just by selling my recordings. And that was a bit naive looking back because I haven't got to that point. And nowadays I didn't even want to go there. But I don't think I sold anything for a few weeks. And then I became so disappointed. I just didn't even think about it anymore. And then very slowly it started, the sales started to trickle in. The good feedback started to trickle in. And I became encouraged again and became optimistic again about it. So I think, yeah, there was a bit of a, like initially I was very excited about starting Mindful Audio. I put together the website. I thought about how to organize more sound recording expeditions. I was a bit on a roll like that. And then when I didn't see the sales, I became so disappointed that I thought, well, maybe this was just an error. Maybe this I shouldn't have started or even thought about it. So my expectations met the reality and it was a bit rough for a while. And then as sales started to come in, I realized that, well, you know, I had my expectations way too high. no one even knew about me as Mindful Audio. I'd never sold any of these. So it was very organic again, from one sale a month, maybe, or two sales a month, to getting, you know, selling more and to having more recordings out there and more libraries out there.
And so now you're well into this this process of yours, and you've got quite a few collections under your belt. You've gone on recording adventures to some really cool places, like all over Africa, the Amazon jungle, into the wilderness of Sweden and Norway. I'd really like to dive into some of these, especially this collection you have called Volcano, which you recorded in Ethiopia at Erta Ale Volcano. So that's not exactly a hospitable area to hang out in. I was watching some videos on YouTube, and the one travel person, she had a like gas mask on just to even hang out in this area where the volcano is active. So how did you like prepare for this trip? You had talked about choosing mics that could withstand humidity and things like that. So when you were going out to record the volcano, what mics did you choose? What recorders did you choose? And how long did you actually stay there?
Right, yeah. I went to Ethiopia in 2019. That was my second trip to Ethiopia. First time I went there was 2018, and I just went to the southern part, to the cloud forest. And I really loved it. It was, for me, Ethiopia is still probably my favorite country to visit. And it's just because there's so much variety in terms of landscapes, of weather, of wildlife, or the lack of wildlife. And I don't know, even the food. I absolutely love the food. Sorry about that. Ethiopian music is really good. It's fascinating. And I wanted to go back. I knew I wanted to go back. And when I planned the trip in 2019, I realized that I had an extra week that I could use for whatever I wanted to do. So I stretched that to 10 more days. So after I did my trip to the south in the cloud forest, I drove back to Addis Ababa, to the capital. And then I met two of my friends. And then we drove up to the north, where there's like some of the most inhospitable and hot and arid parts of the world over there. And I didn't really think about it in terms of what gear to have, because I also had to record in the south where there was humidity and it was pretty cold as well. So I just thought about the equipment that I had that was the sturdiest and the most well-built, which is usually my Sound Devices 633 recorder and my Sennheiser microphones. And I also had low microphones that I hadn't really worked with in such heat. I think it went up to about 48 or 49 Celsius. I think that's about 120 Fahrenheit or so. And I have never tested my equipment in such heat. And I'm not a big fan of putting my gear into the oven or into the freezer to test, because it's, even if you may get the same temperature, it's not necessarily the same conditions, like smoke or dust or whatever. So going there, it was a bit of a, I wasn't really sure how things would end up. Sometimes I knew that my equipment can overheat. The recorders sometimes overheat even in less than 50 degrees Celsius. So I had a lot of redundancy. I had many recorders with me and many mics and blimps and everything else, just in case something would burn or melt or something. So when I got there, before getting to the volcano, we went to a few different parts of Ethiopia in the north, where it was still very hot, but there wasn't any smoke or there wasn't any lava around. So my equipment kind of got a chance to acclimatize. And me and my friends, we got a chance to acclimatize. And we got used to the impossible heat and the wind and the dust. So when we got to the volcano, I think we were in pretty good shape. We were okay to hike up the volcano in very high heat. The one thing that I didn't really think about, as you said earlier, is that you should use masks when you get to the edge of the volcano. I was relying on one of my friends. I was there with a friend of mine who's a photographer and with his father who's a geologist. So I was kind of relying on my geologist companion's knowledge of these phenomena and of these places. So I planned everything else with my local contact. We had to get a cook with us. We had to get a security detail because there's some separatists in the area, and sometimes there's a bit of unrest. And I had a lot of other things on my mind that kept me from thinking about how do we survive on the edge of a volcano? How do we deal with the smoke and everything else? So as I got there, I realized that my geologist companion, he didn't really know much. He was focusing on completely different things in his work. So we just bought like basic turbans from a few kids in a village that we used on our face as scarves to filter some of that. But obviously that's not enough. And luckily nothing bad happened, but reading about things afterwards, sometimes people die because they go there and they inhale this smoke that has silica bits or silica crystals in it. And when you inhale them, they make these tiny cuts in your lungs, and then you have these internal hemorrhages that are not pretty pleasant or even, I'm not going to go into more detail, but I was a bit retroactively upset with my own lack of research before the trip, because I normally do a risk assessment. I think about all these things, but that back then there was a lot of things for me to do, and I skipped this stage of preparation. But luckily nothing bad happened. We were all fine. The worst thing that happened is one of the porters we had, they had been there many times, so they were aware of what the risks were. And we had our guide tell us that there are these lava tubes that we shouldn't step on. So you could see them. They were a bit raised from the surface of the lava. There was like a very crusty, porous surface. And he said that, he was kind of touching a spot on the ground with his foot and saying, you shouldn't step on here. And one of the porters immediately just steps on there and goes through, and he had a nasty gash on his foot, but it wasn't worse than that. So I'm not sure if he did it on purpose or not, but he learned his lesson, I guess. And apart from that, nothing bad happened. We weren't even dehydrated because we were hydrating all the time. We did manage to avoid the smoke for a bit on the edge of the volcano. We stayed a bit further away, and when the wind was such that it would blow the smoke away from us, we'd go on the actual edge and take photos and put the microphones over the edge to do sound recording. And that was a very interesting thing, where if you think about it, the edge of the volcano is basically bits of lava, and lava is very porous, as I said, and it can break very easily. So it's not a safe location to be in on the edge of an active volcano on a bit of lava. So I flew my drone over the volcano, and I could see that the edge was protruding to the exterior. So basically when you were on a ledge, it was just a very tiny surface, and below you there was a big gap. So it was very difficult to put your ears or your head above the edge. So our guide, this guy who had been there for maybe 100 trips or even more, he had never heard the sound of the volcano. He was just there. He could hear it indirectly, or the reflections and the distant and the low frequencies that would pass through the lava. But as I put my my blimp over the edge, I could hear, I put on my headphones and I could hear the actual sound. And then I passed him my headphones, and he was listening, and he started crying because he had never heard this. It was a very touching moment. And then everyone else, even the porters, I let them listen for 5 to 10 minutes each. And they were so happy. It was incredible. You could see the joy on their faces, because they had never actually heard this. They could see it. They had seen 1,000 photos. They'd been there. They could walk around it. But the direct sound of the lava and the gas escaping and everything else, the lava bombs, that was something that was not possible for them to listen to. So it was a very touching moment. When I got back, I listened to that over and over, and I really enjoyed that sound. I really like that sound. But discussing it with them, they were saying that sometimes it sounds like human voices, like people yelling, or like the bowels of the earth, like hell or something. And listening back in the studio to that, I can kind of get that, because it's wideband. There's a lot of very loud noise happening. There's not really a lot of contour to the sound, so you can basically, your brain can interpret it in so many ways. And I think I managed to focus as much or defocus to listen and to eventually hear something that came to people screaming.
That's insane. That's really awesome that you got to capture that sound, one, and that, two, you got to share it with these people who, you know, have experienced this volcano, but you've just shared something, this whole new side of it that they never experienced before. That's really cool.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I was very happy to offer this to them. And as you well know, we are mainly visual culture, so sound is often overlooked or not even thought about. But wherever I go, I end up convincing people that sound is important as well. And that's a big thing for me nowadays, where I try to convince people to listen more and to not focus on the visuals as much. So that was a big win.
That's awesome. So no other mishaps from this trip? I mean, you're getting this gear really close to lava, right? It's really hot. So none of your windscreens burst into flame or anything like that?
No, actually not. So to explain a bit, to give you a bit of background, the volcano was quite deep. I think it was maybe around 50 meters, maybe 100 meters even. So we weren't really that close to the lava. And there wasn't really a lot of lava either. There was mostly gas, which is arguably worse for breathing, but it wasn't as spectacular as lava. So it was pretty hot, but it was, I guess, consistent, you know, even above the volcano. One thing that comes to mind is I was flying my drone above the volcano, and sometimes I felt like it was kind of, there was not enough air pressure because it was so hot. So I almost had it drop into the volcano, but I managed to save it, to move up as soon as I saw it wobble a bit. So I didn't lose that. And no, we ended up smelling like smoke, and like, it was a weird smell. It smelled like chlorine and like burnt plastic and like pretty toxic fumes, like I would say. So we smelled like that for a week afterwards.
That's awful.
Oh, well, you know, it's a small price to pay, I guess.
Yeah.
No, there weren't really that many mishaps. I think we were well prepared, even though, you know, I hadn't included this, the element of inhaling smoke in the risk assessment. Everything else was very well researched. And my local fixer, you know, he had thought about other things as well. So we were there on the edge of the volcano for 2 days, and in the north, in the like very hot part of Ethiopia for 8 or 9 days. And nothing bad really happened. It was difficult to function when it was so hot and windy as well. And then the wind would blow sand crystals into our eyes, or dust or sand. Salt crystals. Yeah, because there was a salt flat in the salt lake as well over there. It was not the most difficult experience I've ever had. It was manageable, I would say. After a while, we got used to it, so we could function, we could take photos, we could do our jobs, even though we were less productive than maybe in more temperate climates or in the rainforest. It was just taking it easy, yeah, so it was not that that complicated.
So let's talk about your latest trip to Namibia. It was a long trip with a lot of stops. So how did you plan for this trip, like in terms of where you wanted to go and what you wanted to capture there, and then choosing the gear that you thought would be best to capture it?
Right. So I had Namibia on my mind for a very long time. I wanted to go there in 2018, but I ended up going to Gabon into the Congo, and then I skipped that. I had been wanting to record the desert. That was very fascinating for me. I was very attracted to this idea to this challenge of recording something that you would think is quite quiet or silent, or maybe there's just a bit of wind. So I wanted to immerse myself into the desert. And I had a few options. For example, the Sahara. There are some places where you can experience it and record it in Mali or in Mauritania or in Niger or in Chad. But these are places where there's a lot of unrest at the moment, so I wanted to avoid that. And Namibia is very accessible. There's a lot of people who do self-drive safaris over there, and there's a whole industry. There's tourism infrastructure, so I didn't have to focus too much on researching if it was feasible or if it was possible to do things. I just got in touch with this company that hires vehicles, and they're... the person who I spoke to, they also helped me with some, they basically consulted on places I could go. And, you know, they told me which places would be more quiet than others. Obviously, this is a bit hit and miss because no one ever thinks about where a place is in terms of anthropophony. But luckily, you know, most of the places that I researched and went to eventually were fine. There was only one place where it was on the Skeleton Coast, on on the coast. And there were a lot of people who were there to do fishing. So there was a lot of traffic. There was a lot of people who, they didn't really seem to appreciate the landscape as much as the fish. So we were there for one night. Then we decided to drive to the next place, even if we had paid for another night. And it was a good decision because we went to a different part, which was much quieter. There was much more wildlife and many more things to record. But basically, I just looked, I have a book on Namibia here, and I read about most things that interested me, like the deserty parts. I wanted to see the Kalahari and the Namib deserts and some of the rocky gravel plains or some of the more still lifeless places, but not sandy deserts, so to speak. So I think I managed to hit most places that I had on my list. It was not easy. Sometimes I had to drive for 6 or 7 hours every day to get to this place or to the next place. But overall, I think it was a success. I'm just about finishing a library of desert sounds that I hope I'll be able to release this week. And just listening to them instantly transports me back there. And there's so much detail. And this is exactly what I was looking for. I wanted to be in a place where you'd think there's nothing happening because there's mostly sand or mostly rocks. And then as your ears get used to the lack of sound or to the very low soundscape, to the very subtle soundscape, you start hearing all of these minute details like wind blowing sand over a hard crust of sand, or vegetation being blown around by the wind, or very distant birds calling here and there, mainly alarm calls, or barking geckos, which was like the iconic sound of the Namib for me. So I got all of this and loads more. I was very happy with the result.
And one of the things that you were after that you said in your blog were the famous singing sand dunes. They continued to evade you, it seemed. Did you eventually get to capture any?
Right. So the singing sand dunes, I'd known about this phenomenon for a long time. And a friend of mine managed to record them in Mongolia. And I knew there's some in Namibia, but there's no indication anywhere on the internet or on where they are. So I had to just stop in a lot of places and go and try to make them sing, basically. But yeah, to cut the story short, I found some of these sand dunes that sing, but the conditions were not conducive to that. So I had to make them sing by walking on the sand, basically, and drifting around. And it was not necessarily singing as much as growling or farting even. It doesn't sound as atmospheric as some of the recordings that I've heard. So this sound, I would say it still eluded me. I have to go back and spend more time and wait for the perfect conditions, like the perfect amount of wind and humidity, and to find the perfect grain size of sand. And then I'll hopefully be able to record it. The recordings I made of the sand over there are just basically walking and getting these deep booming sounds every time I walk, which is still fascinating. I'm happy I got that. And I might end up using those somewhere, or I don't know, composing music with that or using it for sound design, but it's not the sound of singing sand dunes that I was after.
So you go on this trip to record the desert, you know, with all its subtle sounds, and it ends up raining like the first couple days you were there. Is it hard to like stay motivated when it's like, yeah, I'm going to go and like record these beautiful deserts and then there's rain?
Like, yeah, that was totally unexpected. Me and my friend were listening to a podcast about Namibia while we were driving on the first day after we landed. And this, the podcast host was talking about how dry Namibia is, how they hadn't had any rain in 7 years. And we were looking out, and it was a huge storm coming, and it was rainy and floods everywhere. And we said, well, it doesn't really look like it. You know, I don't know. Where are we? It's quite surprising to see so much rain. But it only lasted for 2 days, for the whole duration of our part of the trip in the Kalahari. And I tried to record something. I tried to record some of the rain. There was nothing special about it because it basically rain, which I could record anywhere. So I didn't focus on it as much. I just focused on getting some rest because I hadn't slept in two days before I got there. And then I had to drive for a whole long distance before I got to our first stop. So I just used that downtime to do some photography, to explore, to get some rest. And then as soon as the rain stopped, I could start recording. So it wasn't difficult to take a break, to take recording off my mind for a while. I was just hoping that this wouldn't last for the whole duration of the trip, obviously, because that would have been a bit disappointing. But I've had trips in the past where I got back with nothing. That my trip to Norway, for example, when I went there, it was either raining or there were so many waterfalls and water streams everywhere that anywhere I wanted to record, I would get the distant sound of water flowing. So I gave up. You know, we spent 10 days in Norway back then. I think I recorded for 2 or 3 days and then just gave up because it was impossible. And I just enjoyed my time there, did some research, learned about local species, did some photography. And it was a learning experience. I think it's very easy to get into this mindset of having to come back with something and having to show something for your, you know, the money you've spent or the time you've spent there. But it's not always the case. And it makes it even more rewarding when you do come back with something good from a recording trip.
So you visited a lot of places on this trip to Namibia. Did you have a favorite place where you recorded, or were you really excited about one of the sounds that you captured?
That's very difficult to say because most places that I've been to in Namibia were just exquisite. I think that the element of solitude, of being off the grid for one, without any contact with the outside world, and of being surrounded by wilderness and of being exposed to the elements and to the wildlife, that just made it so much more enjoyable for me. And also the fact that we had our rooftop tent, so we were never tied to one place, even if something bad would happen. So we could always survive. Obviously, you know, if we blew up or overturned the car, that wouldn't be possible. But to a certain extent, we were self-sufficient. We had a fridge and we had a tire inflating compressor. So we were on our own for a big part of the trip, and that really attracted me. And that made the soundscapes even more enjoyable because there was never a distant traffic or distant engines or distant man-made sounds. So I think every time I was out in the desert without any people for tens of miles around, that was perfect for me. It couldn't get any better than that. So places like Namib-Naukluft National Park, that for me was just brilliant. And I would go back there in a second, just because, and I hope I'll go back there sometime because I enjoyed it so much and I never really got to experience it as much as possible, as much as I could. So I couldn't just focus on one part of the trip. I don't know. I liked every aspect of it and I liked most places that I was there in. The desert, the rocky desert, the sandy deserts, even Etosha National Park, which was a savanna landscape with a lot of wildlife towards the end of the trip, that was really good as well for different reasons. So I would lie if I said I had a favorite because everything was my favorite on that trip.
And what about favorite collection of sounds that you've released so far? Is there one that just kind of stands out in terms of the sounds that you collected for that collection or just the experience of creating that collection?
Ooh, yeah, that's a difficult question to answer. I think going to Gabon and briefly into the Congo in 2018 and coming back with so many recordings and then putting that together in a collection called African Jungle, that's probably my favorite expedition to date and my most ambitious one as well. Me and my friend Stain, we spent a whole month in the rainforest, immersed, off the grid, and we were just out every evening to leave out equipment, in the morning to pick it up, out listening, driving from place to place. It was magical. It was really good. And it was hard as well. It was one of my first experiences in such an unforgiving environment. And we were charged at by gorillas and we found snakes in next to our water bottles in the grass. And we were attacked by bees. It was hard. It was difficult. Back then, I wasn't really that hardy, I would say, or that intrepid. So it was like being thrown into the deep end of the pool. But I was I was enjoying it so much. It was just brilliant. And most importantly, the recordings we made, they were mostly clean, free of man-made sounds. We were always away from people, or even when we were in villages, there was not really that much in these villages to have. There were basically a few shacks and nothing else. So we could record, we could just walk for 10 minutes and get out and not hear any more man-made sounds. in one of these places, we could record for, I recorded for 2 days, for 48 hours, without getting any man-made sounds into my recording. And that's impossible in the Western world. So I think African Jungle is still my favorite collection of sounds to date for its variety of things that I captured, for how enjoyable but also difficult it was to capture all that.
So now that you've been field recording for several years, have you noticed any changes, any interesting developments, or some improvements that you would like to see as a field recordist just out doing your job?
It's very difficult because when you're in this industry, it's, for one, it's very tempting to see it subjectively, right? To see you're a part of it, so it's difficult to be objective. But I think, so there have been some changes from 10, 11 years ago when I started. Access to equipment was much more difficult. For example, back then, if you wanted to get decent equipment that you wanted to release a library with, it would cost you a lot of money. Recorders were very expensive. Good microphones were very expensive. So I think over time, over this past decade, it's become a bit more easy to get into the industry. So things, the bar to entry has been lowered because Sound Devices has come up with lower cost equipment that still does a great job. Zoom has upped their game. They released good recorders that don't cost as much as others. And in terms of microphones, you can get low microphones if you're fast enough for quite cheap, and you can record beautiful, you can make beautiful recordings with them. And even the more expensive equipment nowadays is still more affordable than it was maybe 10 years ago. So I think that's been a very good development. Obviously, this has resulted in a lot of people taking up field recording and maybe not appreciating it as much as I did, because I felt I was very much privileged when I started to do it. Nowadays, it seems like a more mundane thing to do, which obviously there's nothing wrong about, but I feel like I grew to appreciate it very organically and to learn and to go on this journey, without having a lot of access to equipment at first. So it was a learning curve, basically. And nowadays I see a lot of questions online, and I get a lot of questions from people who clearly have no idea what sound or field recording is, and they're not prepared to learn the ropes, to learn the basics of it. They just want to go out and do sound recordings. And again, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just going to make things more difficult, because when you haven't mastered the basics, you can only get good results by accident, and you can't really you don't really have a lot of control over what you do. So yeah, I don't know. I've noticed this. I think what's missing nowadays, and as a side note, it's something I'm working on, is a good introduction to field recording online course. It's something that I've been asked about from tens, hundreds of people even. And it's something that hasn't really been done well. So I hope I can do this. You know, I'm very busy at the moment, but I'm hoping that by summer I can start working on this project where I will teach field recording and just the basics, nothing too fancy or too complicated, for people who don't really have a lot of time to go through a lot of different websites to learn things from very disparate sources. So I'm hoping to put all this together in maybe like a 10-hour course or something like that. And then it will be much easier for people to understand what's wrong with their equipment or why things aren't going as well as they expected them to and things like that. So that's a development that I want to happen. I think it's not only myself that I can do it. There's many other people who could do it. And I'm hoping this will become the next direction in which the whole industry moves towards.
Well, once you're ready to launch it, A Sound Effect would certainly love to help you promote it and get the word out there. So let us know. Just one final question for you here. So you have several trips coming up that you've listed on your site. Is there one that you're like really excited about or kind of nervous about?
Right. I'm always excited about travel and about going to places that are not easy to reach, so to speak. So there's a few places that I listed there. There's some others that I haven't, but I still plan on going. I think I'm excited about going back to the Amazon. I've been to the Amazon in 2019, and it was really good. And I still listen to my recordings from there and discover new things and new species in there. So I want to go back and I want to do a bit more ambitious things like canoeing, being off the grid on a canoe or on a kayak for 3-4 days at a time and recording my experience, or going up into the canopy and putting up equipment there and recording and getting videos and photos of what happens, not on the ground where most research is being done and most recording is being done in photography. So this would be a different perspective. And I was supposed to go back to go there in 2020, last year, but obviously I'm not even going to explain why I couldn't.
Yeah, no explanation necessary.
I'm hoping that the situation will get better this year so I can go into Colombia and Brazil. But we'll see about that. There's always a place I can go to. Papua New Guinea has been on my radar for a few years at this point. And that's one that I'm excited but a bit nervous about as well, because I've done some research and I've actually kind of planned a trip there. But a lot of the success of such a trip relies on working with local porters and local fixers. And I've been talking to people at the Royal Geographical Society in London who have been to Papua New Guinea, and their experiences are not ideal. Sometimes they've had equipment disappear. Sometimes they've been deserted by their porters who ran away along with their gear. So it's not always easy when you plan such a trip, especially if you don't have a local fixer. I've found some photographers and explorers who have been to Papua New Guinea and who would be up for a trip like that, so I could join forces with them. And I have some friends who would be able to join me as well. It would be a very costly enterprise, I think. I'm expecting to cost around $20,000 or so per person for about a month or even less than that. But I think that's, you know, when you have a bit more money to spend, you have access to more reliable porters and you can hire more people. There'll be a lot of flying within, you know, in the country on bush planes. That's going to be costly as well. So that's an idea that I'm working with at the moment. Obviously, it's not even open for tourism, so it's impossible for them for now. But I do want to do it, and I'm not sure if I'm ready to do it right now. I might just leave it for next year and focus on some less ambitious trips. But yeah, that's been on my mind for a while, and I'm pretty nervous about it.
Less ambitious, like Antarctica? That sounds like another crazy one.
Antarctica is just costly. It's not that difficult. I mean, I've already researched it, and I had plans to go there last year. But again, it didn't happen. I had two options. I could either join 5 photographers, and I would have been the 6th person on this expedition. And we wanted to hire a yacht and to charter a yacht, basically, and to spend a whole month around South Georgia and Antarctica. And that sounded pretty exciting. It was probably as costly as Papua New Guinea. But there wasn't that much that I had to sort out, because this was, you know, all the responsibility for the navigation and everything. It was down to the crew of this yacht. So I just had to be there, take the good photos and to do the good sound recordings and to, you know, and just do my job and to survive the Drake Passage and to be okay. And my second options would be to find 4 or 5 other sound recordists who are able and willing to share these expenses. And it's not a cheap expedition to organize or to be on. So I had found 2 or 3 people who were okay, they were interested. But obviously, you know, since COVID, everything got shut down. So for the moment, I'm not sure which option I would have. But again, that's not necessarily as intrepid, because there's a crew that's, you know, basically takes care of everything. We just, as sound recorders, we just have to be there and to do our jobs. As opposed to Papua New Guinea, where I would have to be the organizer, and I would have to sort out local fixers and porters and itinerary and flights in the country and survive in the bush and everything else.
Yeah, that's a heck of a lot more responsibility and weight on your mind during the trip, right? You just can't sit back and think about recording. You have all this other...
Well, I think I managed to disconnect the two. You know, when I went to Gabon, that was on my mind as well. I had researched that trip for 6 months or even more before I went there. Up to the moment when I landed, and even a few days after, it was never clear how the trip would end. We had a very unreliable fixer who some days was very happy to help us and to translate for us and to guide us, and other days was just moody and would sleep in and would never want to go out with us. So that trip was daunting for many reasons. I was nervous about it because I didn't have anything clear. When I flew into the country, I landed there. This guy was supposed to pick me up at the airport. I called him. There was nothing. There was no answer. So I had to take a taxi. And 2 days later, he called me. He said, well, I'm still in the rainforest with tourists. Can you wait there for me for 2 days? So it took him 4 days before we met him. And then another day of negotiation. And eventually we left on this expedition. So back then, that would have been a time when if I hadn't mastered this disconnecting between planning the trip and actually being there and doing sound recording, it could have gone wrong. But once we were on the road and once we were in the rainforest, I completely forgot about all the organizing and all the logistics, and I was just there to do sound recording. So I think it's a skill you can develop. It wasn't that difficult for me, because otherwise the option would have been to be stressed all the time and to not make the best of it and to not make good recordings. So I like to think that I managed to overcome that.
Well, that's a good life lesson to share, just being able to separate what you're there for from the circumstances you had to go through in order to get there.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess there's something to be said about living your life and compartmentalizing like that, right?
Absolutely. Well, George, thank you so much for sharing all these incredible stories with me. Best of luck to you on your upcoming trips. And I'll, of course, be following you on your blog and checking out where you're going and what you're doing. Looking forward to seeing and hearing all of this stuff that you have coming up.
Thank you so much, Jennifer. Thank you for the good questions and for this wonderful conversation.
If you want more podcasts about sound, check out these messages from our friends in the audio podcasting community. You can find them all at audiopodcast.org.
Hi, this is Michael Helms, host of the Location Sound Podcast. On our recent episode, I spoke with production sound mixer and boom op Juan Montoto Ugarte, based out of Madrid, Spain. We talk about working on Terminator Dark Fate and the hit Netflix series Money Heist. Check out the latest episode.
Immersive Audio Podcast, a podcast that explores all things immersive audio. We talk to thought leaders covering the art, science, and business of this fast-changing industry. We aim to inform, educate, explore, and unite the community. Subscribe now on your favorite podcast app.
That's it for this episode. A big thanks to Jennifer Walden for doing the interview and to George Vlad for being on the show. Be sure to subscribe to the Soundfect podcast at asoundfect.com/podcast. Thanks a lot for listening and see you next time. Take care.